Good afternoon. This is Dr. Dan Guerra, and you're listening to Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today is 24/4/24. Nice, even numbers for a, Wednesday afternoon. It's going to be immune cell biochemistry, still in section one, T lymphocyte membrane biochemistry, chapter 11. And we were talking about sphingolipids, particularly glycosphingolipids, particularly sialated glycosphingolipids and sialated polypeptides in the T-cell plasma membrane in association with the immune synapse upon induction of a T-cell receptor response post-presentation from an antigen-presenting cell. So we were basically at the level of glycosphingolipids play obviously a significant role in T-cell mediated immune synapse activation because they're a component of the membrane lipid rafts. The membrane itself, not just the plasma membrane, but all the endomembranous systems, particularly endoplasmic reticulum and the Golgi, and also the protein that is carried on the lipid rafts, which signal in association with the T-cell receptor activation after that antigen presentation. And of the 200 glycosyl molecular species of basic sphingolipids carrying sialic acid, along with sialic acid, as I said, being necessary for membrane lipid raft comportment of the polypeptides involved in the signaling towards T-cell activation, the fatty acid content of those lipids is also unique to this dialectical communication between APCs and T-cells, and again, their accompaniment of membrane proteins and lipids. So besides being necessary for lipid class association with raft and synapse interactions, fatty acids also play a role after eicosanoid biosynthesis post-lipase. And lipase, of course, could be any of the phospholipases because, you know, we're not just talking about glycosyl sphingolipids in the membrane, or also the normal accompaniment of phosphoglycerol lipids, including some plasmalogens, you know, as vinyl ether glycerol phospholipids. So those can all be acted upon by phospholipase activity. But in terms of the sphingolipids, think about ceraminidase. Okay? So fatty acid composition and sequence configuration differs tremendously, as we were saying, and it enriches for, in this immune synapse and also in the central nervous system, for those very long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acid omega-3 series, but also significantly one omega-6 VLC PUFA, and that, of course, is arachidonate, which is directly involved in eicosanoid production, which will be one of the initial triggers of the inflammatory response. In fact, leading to transcription translation of pro-inflammatory cytokines. But of the omega-3, you have EPA, DPA, and DHA, and those fatty acids then are going to play a role in complexity of all of the really most significant biologically active membranes in the body. So the level of polyunsaturation, the placement of those double bonds, specifically in the correct geometry and position, plays a role in the bioactivity of all those membranes, including membranes associated with the immune synapse. So nutrients then directly are going to play a role in immune regulation. So think about micronutrients that can be synthesized because of ultraviolet light infiltrating the dermis, generating vitamin D and its derivatives, but also vitamin D as a supplement. And then, of course, the two essential fatty acids, that we mentioned before many times, linoleic acid and alpha-linolenic acid, omega-6 precursor, omega-3 precursor, respectively. Right? So EPA and DHA, of course, are synthesized directly from alpha-linolenic acid. Both the omega-3 and the omega-6 derived metabolites have direct immune regulatory functions. And in fact, they're generally known as pro-resolving mediators. Okay? And they can be classified into different families. So you know them as prostaglandins, leukotrienes, thromboxanes, and maybe the terms not so familiar to you, merecins, protectins, and the specific class of resolvins. Now, we talked about these recently. So with the whole inflammasome project we were on, remember? But remember that their synthesis is orchestrated by cyclooxygenases, lipoxygenases, and or cytochrome P450 enzymes. Okay? So a little bit of this. The eicosapentaenoic acid can be acted upon by cyclooxygenase 2 or cytochrome P450 that generated 18 hydroperoxy eicosapentaenoic acid. And that fatty acid will then be converted to an hydroxy. So from a hydroperoxy to hydroxy, so it's called 18-HPEPE to 18-HEPE, the hydroxyeicosapentaenoic acid. And then after further activity of either the 5-lipoxygenase or the 15-lipoxygenase, or in combination, the resolvins are generated. This is all from EPA, eicosapentaenoic acid. And the resolvins are called RVE1, E2, and E3. Right now, I won't give you the IUPAC names or their specific common names. That's good enough for now. Now, EPA is also metabolized into the 5 series of leukotrienes, and that's via 5-lipoxygenase. And of course, cyclooxygenase 2 will generate the 3 series prostaglandins and indeed thromboxanes. Now, DHA will be reacted with cyclooxygenase 2 and 15-lipoxygenase, which is of course a type 1 lipoxygenase, generating a 17 hydroperoxy DHA, which can then be epoxidated to the protectins. And so protectins have names like protectin D and then PCTR1, PCTR2, etc. Or 17 hydroperoxy DHA can be reacted with 5-lipoxygenase, and that'll generate another class of resolvins. Okay. And these are called RVD1, D2, D3, etc. Okay. There's multiple forms of those. We're not quite finished. Docosahexaenoic acid can also be reacted with the 12-lipoxygenase, generating the 14S hydroperoxy DHA. And then via the reaction of enzymes like epoxide hydrolases or just standard hydrolases, the merecins are formed. And these have acronyms like MCTR1 and 2, and then just simply merecin 1 and 2. Okay. So you get the idea that all the fatty acids that are playing a role in the sphingolipids that are associated with the plasma membrane in the T cell, and then interacting with sialic acid residues with the polypeptides in those membranes and in association with the antigen-presenting cell, means that these lipids are playing any number of very significant roles in modulating the immune response. So I'll only tell you a little bit about macrophages, and then we'll move on from here and talk about yet another unique feature of these processes. So with macrophages, remember they surveil and they reside in multiple organs. And of course, one of the main functions of macrophages is to be surveilling for the potential of invading pathogens. So remember, macrophages are able to recognize specific pathogen-associated molecular patterns. And thanks to toll-like receptors present on their surface, there's a specificity to those PAMPs. After the pathogen is recognized, the macrophage then initiates the elimination process by engulfing it, that's phagocytosis, and then secreting multiple types of antimicrobial molecules. For example, just simply reactive oxygen. Now, at the same time, the macrophages are producing and secreting a large variety of cytokines and chemokines in order to recruit and activate many other classes of immune cells, both of the innate and the adaptive response, right? It's because there you might be mounting, depending on the concentration gradient, and of course, the robust nature of pathogen replication and infection, a very efficient immune response to completely eliminate the threat. So a macrophage is activated by PAMPs and then interferon gamma are known as the classically activated M1s. And they secrete tumor necrosis factor alpha and interleukin 1 beta. And then the macrophages direct their actions toward pathogen elimination. So they produce these antigenic peptides from the destroyed pathogen to present them to adaptive immune cells, which subsequently initiate the more robust immune response. Now, in contrast, macrophages can also be activated by interleukin 4 into alternatively activated M2 macrophages, which will secrete interleukin 10 and start to promote tissue repair and staving off the pro-inflammatory response. Okay, now, omega-3 fatty acids provoke major alterations associated with gene regulation with macrophages. In fact, treatment with macrophages with docosahexaenoic or eicosapentaenoic acids will induce major changes in gene expression in the THP1-derived LPS-activated macrophages. THP1 is a human leukemia monocytic cell line, which is extensively used to study monocyte macrophage functions in cell culture. So they're involved. So these THP1s, these human leukemia monocytic cell lines, can carry out signaling and also an association with addition or subtraction of specific nutrients, such as essential fatty acids, essential amino acids, or the products of the essential fatty acids, DHA, EPA, and DPA. Okay, so that cell line, THP1s, are common to estimate modulation of monocytes and macrophages, don't you know? So when you add DHA or EPA, you induce major changes to these THP1 cells. And of course, you're activating them with using something like lipopolysaccharide. Now, LPS activating either THP1 or frank native macrophage type 1, either with LPS or DHA EPA, activate them differentially. Okay, so most of the eicosapentaenoic acid regulated genes belong to cell cycle regulation, and most of the DHA regulated genes belong to the immune response pathways. Similarly, the addition of omega-3 fatty acids, either DHA or EPA, into the growth cell culture medium for macrophages, not just with THP1s, will induce significant global changes in microRNA expression. Okay. So, for example, macrophages treated with DHA in combination with or without LPS will result in alterations of expressions of microRNAs, which go on to regulate gene expression via RNA-RNA-mediated responses, and therefore, downstream from that, signal transduction, immune defense, growth differentiation, and transport-associated gene products, some of which go back to the induction of the immune synapse with the T cell. Such proteins that we've been talking about that are silylated or simply just modified after silylation or even prior to silylation, the asylase, for example, with galactose, glucose, fucose, and all the other carbohydrates we were talking about the last couple of lectures. Okay? So there's a lot to say here about what these potential fatty acids coming off of the sphingolipids that are involved in membrane raft transport of proteins to the T cell membrane, right? That we've been talking about for the last 10 lectures. I'm going to now stave that off. We're going to talk about a unique aspect of this response. Okay? So, lymphedema is a chronic state of what is known as lymphatic vascular insufficiency. And typically, clinically, it's characterized by a regionally impaired immunity, interstitial edema, that's why it's called lymphedema, deposition of adipose extracellularly, and that adipose is primarily phospholipid and triacylglycerol with some cholesterol, and then an induction of fibrosis. Now, secondary lymphedema, which is actually the most common form, is acquired from lymphatic vascular damage. That comes after cancer, inflammation, cancer therapy, pharmacotherapy, infection with fungal pathogens, bacterial pathogens, and parasites. But also secondary lymphedema, which is the predominant form, can be generated by chronic venous disease and indeed direct physical trauma. Now, what happens with this lymphedema, secondary lymphedema in particular? There, you get an altered CD4 positive T cell differentiation. And that altered CD4 positive T cell differentiation is involved in a networking of alteration of membrane lipid raft mediated responses at the plasma membrane, which will involve all these other events that we're starting to talk about. And the initial phase of secondary lymphedema is this preclinical response associated with CD4 positive T cell differentiation. Now, via molecules such as sphingosine 1 phosphate, those adhesion proteins we've been spending a lot of time talking about, CCL2, and now adding one new feature, lymphatic endothelial cells, LECs, will facilitate the lymphatic transport of tissue, fluid, antigens, antigen-presenting cells, all going to the draining lymph nodes. Okay, where they're going to be interacting then with T cells. So these LECs, these lymphatic endothelial cells, are critical immune cell modulators. What do they modulate? T cell activation. So not just APCs, now you got LECs. These are endothelial cells that will activate T cells and then generate often an immune tolerance in peripheral tissue. And that immune tolerance can be directly mediated by programmed cell death, and by protein ligand inhibitory pathways, which are involved in major histocompatibility complexes, okay, which will then generate a response that causes tolerance rather than inflammation. It's a normal thing that these LECs are provide or obtain in this response. However, LECs can also inhibit the maturation of dendritic cells, and that further can incapacitate the ability to activate T effector cells, like, for example, TH1, TH2 responses, and TH17 too, I should imagine. So what's interesting about all of this is sphingosine 1-phosphate receptor 1 is the most highly expressed isoform of all of the S1P receptors in lymphatic endothelial cells. And it seems to be a necessary receptor to prevent lymphatic hypersprouting and promotion of lymphatic maturation. Okay. Now recall that sphingosine 1-phosphate generation is controlled by one of two sphingosine kinases, 1 and 2, right? And it turns out sphingosine kinase 1 expression and the lyase that degrades sphingosine 1-phosphate, remember that one? 2-phosphatoethanolamine, and the phosphatoethanolamine is then going to be involved in plasmalogen biosynthesis. Remember that? Those two enzymes are significantly downregulated in lymphedema, in the murine model at least, and also in clinical isolates from people with type 2 or secondary lymphedema. Okay? So it's possible then that sphingosine 1-phosphate signaling dysregulation is going to enhance this lymphedema, which again is a pathological state, right? So the LEC, sphingosine 1-phosphate receptor 1 expression, has been demonstrated to be diminished both in clinical and preclinical lymphedema skin tissue, where this first presents. So LECs with a reduced sphingosine 1-phosphate receptor 1 will then skew T cell differentiation toward TH1, TH2 phenotypes in a contact-dependent manner, thus generating a pro-inflammatory response. So mRNA sequencing analysis has shown that sphingosine 1-phosphate signaling deficiency enhances LEC expression of P-selectin, which you know is a major adhesion molecule, which regulates T-cell trafficking and activation. And you know that blocking P-selectin directly attenuates TH1, TH2 differentiation, which is induced by the sphingosine 1-phosphate receptor 1 deficient LECs in culture. Okay? So, in fact, anti-P-selectin monoclonal antibody treatment directly reduces TH1, TH2 cell proliferation in lymphedema. So now you get another feature that's going on directly associated with lymphatic endothelial cells. Now, that comes from a paper published in Circulation just last year in 2023. Okay? So now you've got a solid understanding of where sphingolipids, and then I was just starting to introduce to you, but we already had discussed it to some degree with our discussion of inflammasomes, if you recall, the whole ordering of the inflammatory response because of sphingolipids and phosphoglycerol lipids after lipase or ceramidase activity, and then lipoxygenase, cyclooxygenase, and P450 monooxygenase activation of the eicosanoids, some of which can be of the pro-inflammatory classes. And then there's this whole host of resolvins, which you know inhibit the inflammatory response. And we just went through that. Okay. So this complexity, we were starting to discuss at the epistemological level at the end of last lecture. So I'm going to get back to that. I told you that we have to consider all of the activity in biochemical processes linked with both spatio and temporal organization. And so time is the form of phenomena, I'm going to call it a rational form, and space, of course, is the recognized other rational form of all species of sensorial events that need to be found within spatiotemporal interactions. Now, why am I all of a sudden going into spatiotemporal interactions? When I said I was going to be epistemological, that sounds metaphysical. It's because both metaphysics, epistemology work together to explain one relationship to the other. Once again, a dialectic keeps on showing up. Good old Plato with his dialectic, right? Right. Now, just hopefully you can follow along. I know you can. I know it's not intellectually that challenging. But I know I shifted from a whole discussion of our major topic, T-cell membranes and the activation of the immune synapse. But I'm going back to this epistemology, and I also have to do some metaphysics, so that we remember how this whole process that we're describing comes into, first of all, the research literature, and then through me to you via my lectures, so that you get a better understanding of some authentic biochemistry, whatever the topic happens to be. But a priori to that, keep in mind that spatial-temporal discussion we have, such as the movement of the proteins and membrane lipid rafts in association with specific sphingolipids, all of that is our description of natural phenomena. So recall that the entire level of description that comes from our intellect utilizes spatio-temporal coordinates, and that we're placing those spatio-temporal coordinates into our elaborate production of biochemical descriptions in nature, that we're placing that biochemical phenomena in the living systems. When I say placing it there, you could argue, like Isaac Newton would have in his discussions of astrophysics, for example, that he is discovering what's going on in the natural world, right? And he and Leibniz generated calculus to be able to get to a clearer understanding of that. But a better way to look at it, really, is it's not so much a discovery in nature. It is an introduction into the natural world with our intellect and free will so that we explain the natural world, right? Using our sensoria, which is, you know, again, the adaptation of the natural world to a phenomenological sequence that becomes our reality, right? So that's why it's important to understand this at the micro level, at the cellular level. It's all spatial-temporal, but it's because we are spatial-temporal and we're describing it, right? So to say that that is noumenal, that that's really what's happening, you know, beyond that, right? We can't really get outside of our sensoria. So the whole thing we're describing is it comes from our ability to see and to describe spatiotemporal phenomena. Okay? So let me see how much time I've got left. And this out, this is just, oh, no time left, of course. Dr. Dan Guerrero, Authentic Biochemistry, 424-24, saying bye for now.